Hey, David.
Yes, Rachel.
My next book is about life in zero gravity.
Really?
Yeah, you won't be able to put it down. Welcome to Wizards and Spaceships, the podcast where today we're adding a little science fact into your science fiction. Suspension of disbelief is a cornerstone of speculative fiction, but as writers and fans, we often find ourselves wondering just how grounded in reality our favorite stories really are. So we asked you, our listeners, for questions like, what would happen if I went through a wormhole? Does a Star Trek transporter just kill you and create a new copy of you? What kind of technology can or can't you use to blow up the world? And you didn't disappoint. Also, a lot of you have questions about sex in space, but I'm here to co-host a podcast. Not to judge. Anyway, here to answer your most pressing sci-fi, fantasy, and horror questions are the science bros, Rob and John Mound. John is a professor of geophysics who studied physics, geology, and mathematics. His favorite questions involve real science in weird situations. Rob is a biology and science teacher who studied biology, environmental science, and economics. His favorite questions are the off-topic questions. Welcome to the show, guys.
Hello.
Hello, thank you.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, so you guys both have experience consulting on science fiction, is that right?
We do. I've done a few books. I've done a book for one friend. I don't know if I'm allowed to say who or what, but they did something about CRISPR mostly, but also it was set during the forest fires in Canada, which was sort of interesting. And another friend of mine, again, I don't know if I can say who, has a book going to Scholastic, and it's a climate change story for children. And also I got to look at Blight, which was nice, and look at some of the science in there around polar vortexes and minnows and various other things. So that was a lot of fun. I like when books and stories are trying to get it right, and it makes it worth caring about whether it's right or not. It's not just magic, so.
And speaking of getting it right, I hear that John was a science consultant for the 2003 classic, The Core.
It's true. Sad, but true. True. It's definitely true. Yeah, I was working at the University of British Columbia when they started filming. They needed someone who knew something about the deep earth, and that is what I was studying. So yeah, they called up the university and found me. And I had no impact on what they ended up doing.
See, I changed my science when Rob pointed out some of the errors there.
Yeah, well, they were interested in knowing about the science, but mostly they were interested about telling the story that they were telling. And, I guess if they stuck strictly to the science, they wouldn't have had a story at all. Fair enough.
Right. I like that they had they had Terranauts that were in an Earth ship made of unobtainium, and I think that's
And
really like a good setting for the whole story.
giant lasers. Love the giant lasers.
And that America was creating a weapon which stopped the core of the Earth from turning, and then the solution to all problems will be, of course, nuclear weapons around the core of the Earth rotating again. So that it was really a great show. I truly enjoyed it, and there was like 10 or 12 of us that waited in the theater till all the credits came through, and we were cheering for the science advisors at the end. It was a great movie.
I love it. So, should we get to the questions? We had a couple questions that had to do with one particular scene in The Expanse, which, as regular listeners of the show will probably know, it's one of my favorite sci-fi shows ever. It's so good. So Francois asks, could you actually throw yourself in the void of space from one spaceship to another and survive like Naomi did in The Expanse? If yes, what's the estimated length of exposure before the first major injury or organ failure, assuming maybe a breathing mask? And then related to that, Rachel, not me, another friend named Rachel, asked, I've always wanted to, in a morbid way, know what happens in detail in the first couple minutes of a human body in space without a pressurized suit. Like, do blood vessels freeze or explode? What happens with the lungs? How long would this experience be, or would it be instantaneous? So lots of people who are interested in jumping out of spaceships without a spacesuit for some reason. I love our listeners.
I think in the first seconds you will experience regret because you have left behind a perfectly functional spaceship for the cold, void of space, which is going to kill you. I think that's going to be your first thing that will happen. I think there's going to be like a fast pressure change. And so just like in scuba diving, you don't want to be holding your breath because your lungs will be expanding. The gases in your lungs will expand and that will cause a lot of damage. And in the scene, because I have seen the scene and I love this show, Naomi does it. They do it really well. Like she has her mouth open through that scene and you see the air coming out, which I think is correct. And it looks pretty accurate. I suspect that there would be pressure changes in ears and sinuses and anywhere else, which would potentially be damaging, but would certainly be unpleasant. I think your real problem, though, isn't that it's cold or anything. It's that the water boils in a vacuum at something like negative 90 degrees Celsius. And so I think in Star Trek, people were once described as ugly bags of water. And I think that's broadly correct. So Naomi is going to have like her blood, her urine, her synovial fluid, her, you know, lymphatic fluid, her cerebrospinal fluid is all going to start to boil. And that is going to be quite unpleasant. And she'll get the bends right quick. And fun fact, when you have that expansion of gases or in your tissues, if it's in your joints, it's called the bends. But if it's in your lungs, it's called the chokes. And if it's in your brain, it's called the staggers. So I think she's going to get like all of that. The other problem that she's going to have is that the transition from liquid to gas requires energy. And that means water either has to be negative 90 or it has to boil. And where it's going to get that energy is from you. And so while you're exhaling these gases out of your lungs, presumably, you're going to be freezing your mouth and nose. So I don't think a breathing mask would help, but a scarf might not be a terrible thing in this situation. I think you're on your way to unconsciousness. I read a book, A City on Mars, which is a great book and I would recommend it. But they give an example of someone that was in there and they were in a vacuum and testing a space suit and the hose detached. And when that happened, they like immediately went unconscious. So I think one of the things about the Expanse is they often try and get science right. And I think they really do an admirable job. And in that jump, it takes Naomi about 10 seconds. And I think that's probably generous. I don't know if you're going to get 10 seconds, but that's probably the long end of, I think they're probably right that you're not going to get very much time to jump across space and open a door.
I mean, the thing I found in some of the studies that I found, there's been a bunch of research done on, you know, decompression problems was, yeah, you know, 6 to 9 seconds of useful consciousness before you black out for various reasons. So that's, you know, not good. It was hard to tell in the scene, but if there was any like differential movement between the spaceships, I'm not sure that you would be able to actually, how well you'd be able to jump and hit the point you're trying to get to. And she had to actually like, you know, grab hold of the actual door. It would be tough. And then another thing about space that's often a misconception is it's not necessarily cold. It depends how far you are from the sun. The surface of the moon in the daylight is 120 Celsius. So depending where you are, you could also cook before you freeze.
Oh, wow. I did not realize that.
Yeah, there's lots of shielding. The reason why spacesuits are white is to reflect light away so that you don't cook, right? So yeah, there's a lot of hot. I mean, if you go stand outside today, even with like 100 kilometers of atmosphere or whatever above it, it's still warm, even in the winter here, right? So it's even warmer without all that atmospheric shielding.
Yeah, top tip, the sun is hot.
Top tip. Yeah. Heard it here first, folks, on Wizards.
In fact.
I would also say that two other things, like we evolved on a planet with gravity. And so like jumping from one place to another, I'm not sure if you would hit it. Like the same thing that my brother was saying, that I think you're likely to just like float off into space. Like you get your 6 seconds of regret as you miss the target and float off into space.
Yeah, particularly if you've not ever trained for it, you would expect like parabolic arc like we get on Earth, and you just wouldn't get that. You would just go straight. And once you're out there, you've got no way to adjust your trajectory unless you've, you know, brought something with you. The classic fire extinguisher to push you around kind of thing. I think that's what they did in WALL-E.
Yeah, also in The Martian, they have that sort of like thing to try and direct themselves, I think. Fun fact about spacesuits too is like they're really hard to move in if they get fully pressurized, because if you put a full atmosphere of pressure, then you just stay Puff Marshmallow Man and you can't really move around too well. And so they only fill them to about 1/3 pressure so that people have the ability to move their arms and such. And the problem that then causes is you still get, I mean, your blood won't boil, but you will still have nitrogen gas coming out of your blood, and you'll get the bends from that too because of the low pressure. So one of the things they do is, like, before astronauts actually do a spacewalk, is they breathe oxygen, like, they to purge their blood of nitrogen gas. And so all of the scenes you see, whether it's in, like, Matt Damon in Mars or Bruce Willis on that asteroid where they just slap on a spacesuit and jump outside, like, that's not going to work. That's, they also are going to have regret pretty quickly, I would suspect. So, and they never really show that. Like, spacewalks are, they're not, you don't just jump out of a spacesuit. They take a lot of time to prep for that. And it's one of the most dangerous things people are doing.
Yeah. So listeners, I think the takeaway from this is if you're going to go to space, stay in the spacecraft. Don't jump out of the spacecraft. Same rule when you're in a plane as well.
Don't jump out of a perfectly good plane.
Yeah, the next one is from someone named Gaynor, and their question is one from a Voyager episode, but it's also kind of based on something that's obvious, what they call cybolics. If aliens can suck out all of someone's neural energy, so they're comatose but have a separate energy being floating about, but then the holo doctor can recreate the neural energy, and Gaynor is actually rolling their eyes while they're typing this question. Why can't he just make copies of everyone's neural energy so if they die, they can just be reinserted into a robot body? Like, surely this would be the super obvious thing to do for dangerous missions and shit, right?
I think I get this one, and I would just say this is Star Trek, so it's just technobabble. But if you look beyond, like, disbelief for a moment about holo doctors and energy beings, and, like, neural energy is really not exactly a thing. Like, we have energy, right, because there's electrochemical gradients around neurons, and there are membrane potentials, and there's mitochondria producing ATP and such. But if you were to take somehow energy and put it into a thing, you would have to put it into a built structure that mimics our brain. And so Google recently did a 3D map of 1 millimeter of our brain, which 1 cubic millimeter, which is 1/1 millionth of our whole brain. And they got 150 million synapses over 60,000 cells and 1.4 petabytes of data. And that just gives them a rough map of, like, a small amount of our brain. And I imagine that's going to have lots of errors. And as a result, like, you know, like, if somebody gets a brain injury or a stroke, like, we don't really understand the emergent properties of consciousness and personality and memory and thoughts and feelings and all that stuff. But I suspect even a very small error rate in this brain mapping is going to lead to some pretty bad effects on humans. So if we could do it, I don't think it's possible. Also, like, the idea of the energy, right? Like, if you just take a single neuron or a single synapse, you would need to know, like, where all the, like, potassium, sodium, calcium, chlorine ions are. You'd have to know all the local currents. You'd have to know whether the gated channels were open or closed, what the sodium potassium pump was doing at any given moment, concentrations of neurotransmitters, concentrations of sugar, concentrations of oxygen, you know, which metabolic pathways in a mitochondria are currently inhibited. Like, the amount of information you would need for, like, one synapse or one cell is well beyond the amount of information in this, like, 1 millimeter thing. It's just on orders of magnitude, so much so as to be, I would just say, magic. Like, it's technobabble and magic. But, you know, if you can teleport people by disassembling and reassembling them, then sure, yeah, you should do that. Get a robot. They should have thought of that. Yeah,
they do that a lot in Discovery and Strange New Worlds. They do a whole bunch of hinky things with transporters where they're essentially able to preserve a copy of a person, which makes me wonder why they don't do it with everyone. There's some techno babble about energy use, but nevertheless, come on.
The doctor's daughter gets stored in the transport buffer area or something for a long time, which was pretty cool, but.
Yeah. And one of the other things is the reason we send robots to Mars is because they can do the job and we don't have to then send a person, which is much more dangerous and much more expensive. So if you can do it even better, I'm not sure why you would send people at all.
Well, to boldly go where no one has ever gone before.
Preferably not in an exploding spaceship. I think they've been having some recent issues in explosions and whatever that company is.
I think they call that unscheduled disassembly.
Yes, that's a phrase.
So, speaking of terrible tech ideas, another one from Gaynor. Also, if I trained an AI to respond to everything exactly as I would say for 46 years, then released it into the wild, how long would it take before we behaviorally diverged?
So it's hard to know, but I guess there are a couple of things. One is that AI, machine learning systems, more data and more training doesn't necessarily help you. Sometimes you can train things more and they will do a worse job of predicting the outcomes once they get turned loose on sort of the real world examples. So having the 46 years might not help more than having a year if you had the right data to look at. And then I think the other thing is pretty fast, not necessarily for a technological reason, but just people are complex. We're constantly shaped by our experiences. If I ask you where you want to go for lunch tomorrow, you'll probably give it a different answer than you would today. How would the AI system know that? Because it's not gone past the Cinnabon shop this morning and said, boy, I really want that. That smells good, or whatever. In small ways, not very long. In big ways, at least as fast as people change anyways.
I think it would be immediately, because you would look down and see that you had extra fingers and then not really know how you felt about that and not have a face that you're able to express those feelings with appropriately. And I think the whole thing is going to be a disaster. But also I think people are really, like, more seriously, I think people are quite malleable, and so is our memory. And I think we recreate ourselves and we like confabulate and create stories about our telling stories, right? We're telling stories about ourselves in the past to give us the feeling that we're more stable than maybe we really are. And I think that we're therefore likely to diverge quite quickly. I'm sure there's a smarter philosophical answer to this, but there's plenty of times when I don't even know why I made the decisions I made. So I don't know why an AI would be able to do better. You found yourself in those situations. What was I thinking? I don't even know. Probably the AI is going to have some regrets too.
Yeah, and when you mention about the extra fingers, which is so funny because that's a lot of AI images somehow do that, which is just the whole thing with AI and what it does is so fascinating because it's just very odd. But then it brings me back to Gattaca, because I remember in the movie Gattaca, there was some pianist that mm-hmm. had six fingers on each hand so it could be able to play a specific thing that no one else could. And maybe they were looking into the future. They understood AI before any of us did.
Yeah, Gattaca was all genetic engineering, though. They had a lot of cool like motifs like the spiral double helix staircase and stuff in there. I really liked, but all of that is mostly imagined. I think it was good. It imagined a world where there are genetic haves and have-nots, and I think that was really, really quite cool. And I think we'll have this, if AI was useful, like, we would end up with the same type of thing if some people were enhanced in some way. I suspect they will not.
Well, speaking of extra limbs, a third question. What if octopuses were the dominant species on a planet that also had humanoids? Would they eat tiny slices of human limbs in restaurants? What would technological equivalents look like? For example, buildings and vehicles. It would be so awesome. Honestly, I want this to happen.
My initial thought is, who knows the mind of an octopus? But, the things we do know about octopi, or octopuses, as you prefer, is like they're pretty broad spectrum carnivores, right? They eat what they can eat. And so I suspect that if they could eat the humanoids, they would eat the humanoids. Meat is meat, food is food. I'm sure they're tasty. I suspect they might have a harder time of catching them, though. I think it feels like it would be harder for something ocean-based to sort of fish the land than it is for us to go from the land and fish the oceans. The sort of the density and pressure differences are harder that way. You can't just travel across the land the way you can travel across the oceans. So catching us might be us, not us. Catching the humanoids might be difficult, but they could certainly fish along the shores and catch people that are wandering there. And I don't see why they wouldn't eat them if they could, as long as they were big enough relative to the size of the humanoid. I figure they would. In terms of the technology, it's going to be tough. Like developing underwater, you're in a very different situation. Anything that involves fire isn't going to work. And a lot of our technology ultimately comes around from being able to mess around with fire and smelt metals and that sort of thing. Electricity is tougher because the water is conductive, so it's harder to contain electrical systems to just get that foothold on making things work. Chemistry might be harder because it'll just be, again, harder to sort of keep things contained and not diluted by the water that you're in. But that's maybe a more solvable problem. And so I suspect that they would develop technology really differently just because of the physical conditions that they're working in. And that means a lot of things that we can do easily, they couldn't do, or they certainly couldn't do easily. And so they'd have a really different basis for starting out.
I think also they would need to, a way to pass on cultural knowledge, because right now the young octopi, whichever you prefer, they get no parental care. And so I kind of like the idea of, you know, maybe cave paintings or something like that as a way to, like, communicate to the young octopus. But alternatively, maybe the male octopus could stick around so the female doesn't have to starve to death looking after the eggs. And that could then lead to, like, jumpstart cultural evolution. I think they would need some sort of language, like a more developed language, but they already can do some color changing patterns. And I think you could get some really interesting, language based on changing colors on your skin, or a really complex sign language because they got 8 limbs for the whole thing. So that would be pretty neat. I agree with everything that John said. In terms of structures, because they can't build the way we build, I think they might have to, I think they would be interested in building structures that would exclude their predators. And so they'd want to have lots of tubes and caverns, and maybe something around like coral sculpting or farming or something like that might be a way to create a society. And then they could teach their young inside their little coral mansions, etc. And I don't know if they'd want to eat us or not, but I like the idea that they would have this literature about these Cthulhu horrors with jointed limbs and bones and these alien minds that live high above the sea. I think that they would have some writer would come up with that as a story, and that would be their terror that would affect a lot of their sort of eldritch horror stories, and we would feature in them. I think that would be cool.
Yeah, I think a really good example of world building along these lines is Adrian Tchaikovsky's Children of Time, which takes the idea of spiders evolving for reasons instead of primates, and really goes into the social differences, particularly in gender relations of a lot of spider species and child rearing, but also the kind of communication and technology that they would have based on their physical form.
The next question is from Wing Hang. The question is, is there a way to get a decent internet connection or Wi-Fi in a substructure that is kilometers deep into the ocean? And how do you do that?
Yeah. So for structure, it's easy because it's not moving. You just need a fiber optic cable. That's how we get internet traffic around the world at present. We have cables that span the oceans. They get damaged by, you know, natural hazards, by sharks chewing on them, by other things attacking them or other people. But to a stationary structure, fiber optic cable, that would be pretty straightforward. For something like a sub where it's mobile, that's a lot harder. Wi-Fi is not going to work well at all. Water is really absorbent of electromagnetic energy. It really attenuates really quickly. And so you can only really transmit things for some tens of meters. And then there are technological trials going on that sort of make use of that. The other thing that there is, you can do optical signaling. So there are things you can send light, or you can use sound waves. You can send acoustics, you know, light waves and EM, other light waves and other EM waves don't travel very far. So you would need like lots and lots and lots and lots of nodes to detect the signal, transfer it on, detect the signal, transfer it on. And so you would need a ocean floor just carpeted in these things. And it's sort of the true for sonar systems are also not, you can encode the energy, you can encode the message in the sonar and then send it by sound. Transmission rates are pretty low. So in the systems at present, you can get sort of 100 megabit-ish things, which is enough for internet, but not high speed. So if you want high speed, stick to a structure, lay some fiber optic, you'll be good.
Cool.
I don't really have many comments on that, but I like the idea that like sharks might be joining the Orca uprising and trying to take out our communication networks so that we can't rescue the people when they're going down in yachts.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that's what's going on there.
Wow. All right. So Kitty sent us a video, and I'll excerpt a little bit of the video so that listeners can get an idea, and I'll also link to it in the show notes. But the basic summary is sex in space. Would love your take on this.
But I also think, like, is pretty small up there on like a ship on this ISS.
Mm-hmm.
Shuttle missions, no way. It's the size of like a jet, right? Mm-hmm. And that's it's a tough job to get some privacy up there unless everybody's nasty. And that's a lot to ask for a full flight crew. And there's no way to vent the stink. There's no way.
Apparently, I'm going to be taking this one. So I did watch the video, and there's two things that they talk about. One, they talk about blood pressure, and two, they talk about being pushed backwards during ejaculation. I believe those are their 2 points. Their argument about blood pressure is incorrect. Like, erections are caused by changes in dilation of blood vessels and valves, which restrict the flow back, leading to, like, it's not caused by blood pressure. So the fact that you have a fluid shift up towards your head, that's not really going to cause a problem. Also, the flesh is willing is what I'm trying to say here. There are some space tourists have, in fact, reported having erections. And one American astronaut was asked if astronauts masturbate in space. And that guy got real quiet and then asked if he could take the fifth. So I feel like that's a confession right there. And then a couple of years ago, NASA gave a directive to male astronauts not to masturbate in space because there are female astronauts that could get impregnated by stray fluids. You don't want to think too much about that, but you also don't want to be on a spaceship with 100 people going to Mars because somebody is going to masturbate in space and then the whole crew is going to get impregnated, assuming you brought men along, which you don't need to. Like, you could just send women to Mars and, like, the important parts of men could be freeze-dried if you were trying to, like, you only need a couple grams per man of men. That's all that's really important there. Oh, and in terms of being pushed backwards by, like, a nerd, yeah, I mean, just hold on. You'll be fine. Do you want to do the physics of force, volume, mass, brother?
Yeah, well, I mean, so there's, in principle, it's true, right? It's conservation of momentum. It's how rockets work. You shoot something out one way and you go the other way. But rockets, you need a lot of mass going very fast. And I'm not sure that that's the scenario that's being envisaged here.
I do think pregnancy and birth in space is actually kind of interesting. Like, there's these con men that keep talking about space colonization. There are, like, a lot of things about, like, zero gravity and fluid shifts and what the developmental effects might be. And there's increased radiation in space, which I think is a concern. But they have had fruit flies reproduce successfully in space. And they took some geckos up, but then the life support failed and they froze to death. But currently China is planning to send monkeys into space onto, I forget whether it's to the space station that they're building or the moon base that they're planning to build, but I think they want to send monkeys or chimps to space and then have them reproduce in space. I don't know whether monkeys are going to want to reproduce in space, but I think they actually want to look at what the effects of, like, a primate giving birth to a primate in space look like. And I think that's one of the plans that they have. And I think those questions are interesting anyway. Although I'm pretty negative on all the space colonization nonsense, it is sort of an interesting question about whether it's actually possible to give birth in space in zero gravity and what the developmental effects might be. I suspect they'll be pretty negative.
Don't jump out of a spaceship. Don't have a baby in space. It's not rocket science.
Nice.
So next question is by Mid. They want you to explain why FTL, which is just short form for faster than light, and teleportation violate causality in a way that doesn't break my brain.
So I can't explain. Whether or not I can avoid broken brains is a different question. And it depends, like, teleportation, it depends a little bit on how teleporters work. So if we're looking at the Star Trek teleporters, it's not, from what I could find, it wasn't very clear exactly how they work and, like, what speeds you're going at, but there's certainly some suggestion that you're getting teleported faster than light speed, effectively instantaneously, and so it's still faster than light travel. Faster than light travel and teleportation in that situation would violate causality, where by causality we just mean a thing happens, sometime later another thing happens, and that second thing is caused by the first thing. Cause has to precede the effect. Otherwise, it can't be causing the thing that's the effect. And so not only does it have to happen before, it has to happen far enough before that the information of this thing happened has time to reach the effect. If I see you walking down the street and I shout out your name, the sound has to travel from me through the air to you before you can hear me and then react and turn around and wave hi. And so that's what's required for causality. It takes time for the information to travel from the cause to the effect that over very long distances, it can take quite a long time. And so the reason that FTL breaks that is because the fastest you can send and the fastest you can send information in our universe is at the speed of light. The speed of light, it's not light that's special about it. It's the speed of many things. It's the speed of light. It's the speed of basically the maximum speed of information transfer. It's the speed of causality. And so if you're going faster than light, then you're going faster than information can get from cause to effect. And you would see the effect before you saw that the cause had happened. And so things are out of order. It's no longer causal. Effects happen before the causes that cause them happen, which if we don't think about it too hard, probably doesn't break our brains. If we start thinking about it harder, almost certainly will break our brains. And there's more complicated things when you start looking at how special relativity works and changing reference frames that change things about how time is perceived by different people traveling at different speeds. But the basic principle of cause must happen before effect. If you can go faster than light, then effect would happen before cause, and then causality is broken.
Hmm. Well, my brain is still mostly intact after that, but speaking of breaking people's brains, Nid would also like you to explain why torture doesn't work.
I think I get this one. I would say, like, if your goal is to humiliate and punish and create terror, torture is actually quite effective. If your goal, and I think what Mid is on about, is to extract useful information, then, I mean, it's not exactly good because it doesn't really facilitate memory recall or cooperation or goodwill or anything like that. But I'm not sure that it exactly doesn't work. I mean, people will give up information. They'll say whatever you want, right? If you've got a name, they'll give you the name probably. If they don't have a name, they'll give you whatever name you want, right? And that's the actual problem, that you get useless information. You get whatever you want here, you're going to hear it. And so I'll give you the names, I'll give you the dates, I'll give you the places, I'll make up whatever story you want to hear. And therefore the information isn't particularly any better than, right? Like in some cases, people will give up true names, I imagine. And so I think one of the problems though we have is not just that people are giving up information that's not true as well as information that is true. It's that there's a lot of portrayals in science fiction and fantasy and in some writing and in some popular culture, which like after 9/11 in, there was that show 24 that came out, right? And that was this made up scenario where there was a bomb that was going to go off and they had 2 hours to figure it out. And then they had to like, they got the guy though, and they're going to torture him to get the information, right? So it's a completely fabricated scenario that has never happened, but it was used to justify the idea that, you know, torture could be a useful mechanism in these, and there was a greater good involved, right? And it made torture more palatable. And I think that led directly to things like Gitmo and Abu Ghraib and dehumanizing people for some sort of greater good or alleged greater good. And I think I would like to see some more, I don't know if you have any examples, but I'd like to see more science fiction and fantasy that like sort of addresses that as an issue. Joe Abercrombie has the First Law series and there is a torturer in there, but, and he's seen as a loathsome person, but he also gets answers that are useful, right? So I don't know how I feel about that exactly. And I wonder if there's any books or movies that you guys know about that would be different.
Yeah. Yes. David just wrote in the chat, I see four lights. Mm-hmm. And it's been a while since I've seen that episode of Star Trek, but I think it at least managed to scare a certain generation of geeks into thinking that torture was bad, actually. And if you did it, you were bad, which all kind of got undone by shows like 24 that came along later.
Yeah. So I think you get information, whether it's right or wrong. And, you know, I don't have a lot else to say about it. I'd like to see more critical inquiry in science fiction and fantasy about this. So that's the whole point, is to be speculative, right? And look at the profound negative effects of torture and dehumanizing people and allowing you to do that. So I think it would be a good place for some of those skills to be put to work.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the quote from that, I see only four lights, with David Warner as the Cardassian that was doing the torture, but Picard actually says, you know, torture isn't something that's reliable. And there's this whole discussion about what you know, whether or not torture is something that you can use or not.
Yeah. I guess in 1984, like there's the Do It to Julia. It finally breaks the person, destroys them. Like, so if your goal is to destroy a person, you can probably do that.
And if your goal is to have evidence that you can present at a trial, then it works, right? Because you will get evidence from the person.
Yeah.
But it's gloomy.
Pretty bleak and unfortunately very relevant for our time.
Yeah, maybe it's time to move on to the next question, which I think continues. I think Mid might also have asked, this one. Why don't we use giant cannons for space launches? Which almost sounds like something from that early silent movie, A Trip to the Moon or whatever, Méliès or something. So, and there's an, in brackets, this is mainly because I love hearing people tell the Gerald Bull story. So I'm not sure if I know the Gerald Bull story, if someone can mention that.
Gerald Bull, I believe, is the Canadian who made the giant gun for Saddam Hussein that was... I don't know a lot about him. I think he made a giant, like, Project Babylon gun or, like, a space gun or something that could shoot, like, thousands of kilometers. And he got assassinated eventually by Israel. But he was Canadian and was at, like, McMaster or something. I kind of forget exactly the whole story. Well, you're not going to – if you love hearing people tell the Gerald Bull story, I'm afraid you're going to be disappointed.
That's what Google is for. But the idea of just having a giant cannon for specifically space launches, I mean, I've always thought that it makes sense to build space platforms because you don't have to worry about all that power and all that juice and all the power it needs to actually break Earth's gravity. Because that's serious. That's a lot. But if you actually build your ships in space, in orbit, and have them go from there, you don't need to worry about that. But the idea of actually having a gun seems a bit odd because you have to have enough power in that first shot to be able to get this thing into orbit as opposed to having whatever it is that's making the ship go up. You've got control, so that means if you're going off a bit, you can adjust it. But if you just shoot some sort of a vehicle right from the ground up into space, you've got to be pretty accurate about how you're doing that.
Yeah. And I think one of the things with guns and explosives, it's like it's a one-shot it's very extreme acceleration. Mm-hmm. If you want people in your rocket, they're going to have a really bad time. But even other things, it's, you know, we explode things and they don't usually survive all that well. But, you know, you could send some things up, but the accelerations would be more extreme and harder to control than what we currently do. And so in some sense, we are, you know, sending off giant explosions, but they're much more controlled explosions than just firing a giant cannon and trying to get all of the acceleration, all of the speed that you need in a very short single blast.
I did do some math. Like, rockets apply force over gravity over time. And you're right. Like, so it'd have to all be in the one place. So if you look at the heavy, super heavy, which is the SpaceX thing, and the, what's the thing that sits on top of that? Starship, right? So super heavy has 3,400 tons of propellant, and Starship has another 1,500 tons, most of which is, so that's partly liquid oxygen and partly methane, liquid natural gas. But if you were to release all of that energy, assuming that, you know, you're saving some to come back, depending on what your assumptions are, it's like 9 to 14 kilotons of energy being used. And for perspective, the bomb in Hiroshima was 15 kilotons. And so you're going to get a fairly large crater. I mean, the other thing, though, is like you wouldn't have to. One of the things rockets do is they're like a lot of the fuel is used to lift the fuel that's lifting the whole thing, right? There's wasting a lot of the fuel to lift the fuel, which is why they use two stages and everything else. But even without that, like the amount of force required, and the amount, like John said, like if there's people there, they're not going to survive that type of rapid acceleration. If there's any kind of sensitive science equipment there, it's not going to survive. In theory, like the other thing about SpaceX flights are that they're supposed to be reusable, and something like 6 times out of 8, they have been so far. So they do keep blowing up, but, you know, if you just fire something like off into the space, like it's gone now, right? Like it's never coming home. Like if you were going to Mars with a big cannon, you can't get from Mars back to Earth. You're just going to be there, right? So I feel like, I don't know, we want things that are reusable. So things that get blown up are not reusable. I don't know what you would want to send into space that could survive it. Just a big ball of metal for some reason. I don't even know that it's more efficient, like the amount of energy that you're using in your cannon. Why not just put it in a rocket ship, right? Like I'm not sure that it's necessarily better. For perspective, the space shuttle only blew up twice, and it went like 150 times or something.
So back to Earth for a second.
Let's do that.
Robin asks, what is the most overrated rock or mineral, and what is the most overlooked?
So I have strong feelings. Obviously, all rocks and minerals are super cool and very interesting. But if I had to pick one to be overrated, I would probably pick diamonds. You know, they are really interesting. They've got lots of super useful uses. They're used in lots of industry. They are super hard. They have super high thermal conductivity. They form deep in the earth, hundreds of kilometers down into the earth's mantle. So they're a little, you know, microcosm of the deep earth, but they're valuable and famous because they're shiny and because De Beers' marketing team was really, really good. And both historically and to a certain extent, continuing to the present day, there's some unethical business practices around how diamonds are mined and marketed and sold. And so, although I really like diamonds, they probably catch the eye more than they should.
And you can make fake diamonds that are just as good for those lab uses, right?
Yeah. So there's synthetic diamonds are made now, and lots of diamonds. Most diamonds in the world are not super expensive. They're used for industrial purposes. They're put in, you know, to abrasives on like saw blades or drill bits and that sort of thing to grind your way through the materials because they are so hard. And so most diamonds are not actually very valuable. And you could make synthetic diamonds, which are big and shiny and sparkly. But of course, people don't want synthetic, big, shiny, sparkly diamonds. They want the ones that have them come out of the earth, presumably because they are a, you know, encapsulated from the bit of the mantle, right? And people are really interested in the deep earth is why they value those diamonds so highly.
Is it, or is it like the orphan blood?
Yeah, so there's blood diamonds are a thing, but like any carbon can be made into a diamond. So I have a colleague and who does high temperature, high pressure experiments. And like one of the outreach things that he does is he goes around to schools and gets, you know, collects boogers from kids and takes it back to his lab and compresses it into a diamond. So you have snot diamonds, right? No one's paying lots of money for snot diamonds, though, for some reason. But, like, you can make diamonds relatively easy.
How much would a snot diamond cost?
Yeah, I would also like to know this information.
I really feel like I could express my love and affection with a snot diamond better than I could with a blood diamond. And so if you could hook me up with one of those, like, I'd be interested in price.
And I think the synthetic diamonds tend to be smaller as well than, the really big valuable diamonds.
For my pick for overrated, I would say all asteroids. People keep talking about how there's like an asteroid worth like a trillion times the global economy worth of metals and stuff like that. And I just think that's nonsense. Like if you could get it to Earth without crashing into the Earth and having us go all the way to dinosaurs, you would just crash all the metal markets. Like you can't just take a trillion pounds of gold and multiply it by current prices and expect that to be a real number, right? As soon as everybody has all that gold, like it's nice, soft, it's useful for some things and conductors and whatever, but it's not like we don't have an infinite need for it, right? And like once everybody's got all their fingers covered in gold rings, like what else are we going to do with it, right? So I think that's a little silly. And also like the idea that it's just, oh, we'll just fly up and grab it and bring it back. I'm like, well, no, you won't, right? Like that's not $1 trillion worth of metals is not worth $1 trillion if it costs you $1 trillion to go get it. It's worth nothing. Right. So I really feel like the asteroids are just overrated. Brother, underrated.
Yeah. Sorry, yeah, underrated or overlooked. So my overlooked mineral is ice. Because a lot of people forget that it is just a mineral. It's just a rock. An iceberg is just a rock. Icebergs are really neat, right? Glaciers are neat. The icy moons of Jupiter and Saturn are super cool. You can put it in your drink on a hot summer's day. Fantastic mineral. It won the Mineral Cup in 2019, back when the internet was a more fun place. We, you know, scientists got together and voted on their favorite minerals. Ice won in 2019. So I really think it's a good one.
Albedo and our polar caps too, for its role in cooling the earth, cannot be, overestimated. It's been great. It's doing a great job regulating our climate for years. We should appreciate it more.
Good job, ice.
Good job, I mean, ice.
Except for that ice.
Yeah, that's right. H2O ice, solid. My underrated is phosphates and phosphate-containing sedimentary rocks. I think people greatly underestimate the importance of that. We mine phosphates for phosphate fertilizer, and phosphate fertilizer is 100% necessary for industrial agriculture and, in fact, for all of our agriculture and our ability to feed the world. And the phosphorus cycle requires phosphorus to flow off the land, go into the ocean, sediment out, and end up in sedimentary rocks, and we're going to mine that. So on all practical timescales, that is therefore not a renewable resource, and we are approaching, I would say, peak phosphorus. I mean, prices go up, but there is no substitute for phosphorus, and plants need it, and they don't need any, like they need other things too, but there's no substitute for phosphorus in plants. And unless we have circular agriculture, like right now, our entire agriculture system puts nutrients on soil, gets it into food, sends that to cities, goes through people, ends up in our rivers where it causes eutrophication. And therefore, we have to keep fertilizing our soils. And I think that the fact that we're not running low, but we're getting towards what would be peak phosphorus is something to consider, because through the magic of economics, as prices go up, there will be more phosphorus reserves. But as prices go up and we get more phosphorus reserves, food prices are going up, and that and agricultural productivity will slide as a result. So I think that's important. Also, it's different from things like nitrogen fertilizers, because like our atmosphere is 80% nitrogen or whatever, 82%. And so we've got the Haber process where we can do like just 450 degrees Celsius plus carbon dioxide plus nitrogen, and you're going to get some nitrates for the soil. But that process uses 2% of the world's energy and produces somewhere between 2 and 5% of the world's carbon emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, because we're using like coal in some cases to create the heat to produce nitrogen fertilizers to get them onto the soil. And so if we were to solve the phosphorus problem, we're going to have to solve that by sending manure back to farmland. We will also be solving a nitrogen problem, which means we would also be solving an energy consumption and a climate problem. And I think that's pretty important. Saskatchewan has one third of the global reserves of potash, and we keep sending like 20 million tons a year to America. And like Trump was going to tariff all that, and American farmers are going to be upset about getting that tariffed for sure. We send most of it to them, and they are upset about like the increased price on an absolutely unreplaceable. There's not going to be like a domestic phosphorus production in the States. I mean, there is some, but not in the way that we can from Saskatchewan, because that used to be a big inland ocean. So we have lots of phosphate containing rocks there.
Yeah. Now, I have a colleague who is, that's one of the things that they study, and they are part of a big sort of multidisciplinary project looking at it from all of those angles, from the geology to the agriculture of phosphorus and that phosphorus cycle and that sort of, yeah, closed loop agriculture. And it's a big problem that is underappreciated.
So our next question is, it was given to us from Tucker, but it was actually a question that his husband Carlos had. And that's whether humanity will keep discovering or creating new elements to add to the periodic table. An element is defined by how many protons the atom has in its nucleus. Do we imagine there's a limit on the number of protons an atom can have? Carlos wonders if the larger the nucleus, the faster the electrons travel so they don't fall out of orbit. If that's true, and the electrons can't speed up infinitely, then very large atoms can't exist. There may be other reasons why there can't be an infinite number of elements.
So I'll start with the second part. Is the problem with it isn't the electrons. The problem is with the protons. We're trying to jam a bunch of protons into the nucleus, which is very small. Protons are all positively charged, so they all repel each other. And there's also, you know, atomic scale physics things happening with strong and weak nuclear forces that try and bind things together or cause them to split apart, that make large atoms unstable. It's not really the electrons. It's more what's going on in the nucleus itself. So it's the protons and the neutrons, and the neutrons are sort of there to keep the protons spaced out enough in some sense to allow stability. And so that's, you know, why we don't, it's why, like, in principle, we could make bigger and bigger nuclei with more and more protons. It's just that they would fall apart so fast. Is it even worth saying that we've really made them? There's some sort of theoretical expectations that there might be sort of islands of stability at higher proton counts if you get the right balance of protons and neutrons. And so at proton count 126 and 164, there might be elements at those sort of proton counts that might be more stable than their neighbors. And so in principle, we might be able to make those and have them last, but I suspect they would still be, you know, existing for, you know, tiny fractions of a second, as many of the more recently discovered elements that used to have fun names like unium, but now have actual names. They don't last. They can make them in labs, but they last for tiny fractions of a second.
Fractions of seconds. They don't last. I think they just made 120. I think we finally got 120. So we exist for enough time to describe it and then disappears. So I imagine there's places in the universe where those things happen. possibly during, like, in stars or black holes or for moments of time, but I don't think that we're going to be able to. They're just not stable, and I think it's unlikely. Yeah. The other thing about the electrons, too, like, as you move across a period in it, like, the electrons don't really orbit in the way that it's described or at a specific speed. And as you move across the periodic table, the radius gets smaller because the way shielding electrons work, and they get smaller as you move from left to right along the periodic table. Every time you add a proton, the electrons come closer to the center because the negative is attracted to the positive in the center, and there's less shielding from the other internal electrons, which push them away. And so speed isn't really a problem. I don't have a lot to say about this. Speed isn't really a problem for electrons. I do wonder if they exist in other places, like other than us making them, if there's forces in nature which are sometimes creating these for fractions of seconds. But even if they are created in nature, they can't be stable. They could last for seconds, fractions and fractions of seconds, not seconds. We should be able to smash things together, but I don't know. We could get some bad results at some point too.
Yeah, the whole world will be destroyed. That's what we're worried about, these smashing things together, which was, of course, ridiculous. John has a question about, and this is a bit dark, but when a solar coronal burst strips away 60% of Earth's atmosphere in a matter of hours, how will our species adapt after the huge die-off?
I mean, the short answer is we won't. We'll die off with everything else. The slightly longer answer is I don't think it's likely to happen. The sun does lots of things. It's a very active, dynamic ball of plasma, and it's constantly erupting in various ways, and there are big solar flares, and there are coronal mass ejections. There's the solar wind that's constantly streaming away, and it has smaller events and bigger events. The biggest event that's been really well observed was the Carrington event, which was, I think, 1649, something like that, so much bigger than anything we've seen with sort of modern instrumentation, and that had impacts on Earth in terms of causing issues with like telegraph wires and shorting out telegraph systems and that sort of things. More recent events, which are smaller, have done things like knock out the Quebec power grid. So there are issues for how our technology interacts with this massive burst of plasma being shot out into space and hitting the planet and disrupting electric and magnetic fields. You don't want to be in the space station. Satellites get disrupted. SpaceX had issues where the atmosphere got heated up and that caused it to expand, which increased drags on satellites and caused some of their satellites to re-enter unexpectedly. And so those things are bad, but they're not like extinction level bad. There are bigger events that are known about from the geological record called Miyake events. There was one in 774, and they are about every, few thousands of years, it seems like. And so these are 10 times bigger than the biggest observed event, bigger than the Carrington event. But, there's no evidence of, extra extinction, mass extinctions associated with them. There are records that get created. It does, impact the atmosphere and change the composition. So you get generation of carbon-14 and beryllium-10 due to the interactions of the solar particles. You get some heating of the atmosphere. You get destruction of the ozone layer, which is then not great for some years until it can reestablish itself. And it will impact on Earth's weather, but not extremely, I don't think. For a few years by a few degrees was the modeling study that I saw. So it would be disruptive, but not, rip all of the atmosphere off of the Earth disruptive, not mass extinction disruptive, but possibly technologically disruptive. And, there are real concerns for, what such a big event would do in our highly technological world. We've not had a really big event in our highly technological world, and what it would do to electronic systems and communication systems and satellites and that sort of thing is a real concern. And it wouldn't be easy to sort of restart and rebuild if you have massive infrastructure damage to like power grids.
I didn't have much to say about it. Like, if we did lose 60% of the atmosphere through some process, I feel like life would still be okay, kind of like a lot of things are going to die, like animals and such, but I think some insects could probably get through with that. I think carbon dioxide and oxygen would probably diffuse out of the ocean because we'd have a different pressure, partial pressure of oxygen. Is that right? And so that would be, like, it would do a lot of damage. Like, it would be an extinction level event, but I think life would be fine. I imagine the things at the deep ocean floor would maybe just not even notice. Losing the ozone layer would increase radiation, but I don't know. Do you think the sky would change color?
The sun would be less blue.
Be less blue? Sun, yeah, be less blue because we wouldn't be scattering it, right? And then the sun would probably feel hotter.
So this is how we get our octopus people.
Yeah. Yeah,
this is how we get our octopus people. They're laughing at us.
Amazing. Okay, so many people, both our listeners and unfortunately some of the people running the American government, had questions about living in space, be it the moon, Mars, big circular station. Can it be done?
No.
Yeah. I don't have a lot of thoughts on this other than to say probably not. There are technological challenges that can be overcome. Living on Mars, you want to live underground to avoid the radiation. You've got to somehow account for the fact that the soil appears to be poisonous, that sort of thing. I actually think the technological problems are probably not the issue. It's probably the more social, societal, political problems that you're going to cause problems. Rob might have more to say.
The soil of Mars is filled with perchlorates and stuff. So like if you ever saw The Martian where he just mixes poop with soil, that's not going to work, right? Like the poop idea was good, but you can't just mix it with Martian dirt because it's filled with like acids effectively. The radiation, gene pool problems, bone loss problems. There's so many problems. I imagine like we could have, you know, we can have a space station, right? We could even have things on the moon because it's fairly quick to resupply the moon. And if you had a problem on the moon, like a medical event or something, you know, we could go get you, right? The moon's never that far away. Whereas Mars is often like, well, it's 9 months away when it's on this side of the sun with us, right? And there's times when you just really can't get there. So the idea of going there, it's to set up a society. We could probably maybe get a person there and back, maybe. I don't know. To set up a society, it just seems unlikely, right? For a bunch of other reasons too, right? The ecological and biological reasons. It's not clear that we can reproduce in space. We can't grow food in that environment, right? The sun only produces half the, you know, energy that's coming to Mars, right? So that is going to be hard for photosynthesis, even with, you know, maybe get nuclear powered lights or something, grow lights, but, you know, if you want to live on hydroponic lettuce and convert it to protein via crickets and mealworms, like while living underground, I don't know. Like I think the idea about going to Mars, the most useful thing about the whole project isn't what we're investing money in. We're investing money in big rockets, which seem to blow up 25% of the time. What we could be doing though is investing money in like circular economy, how to make sustainability work. You know, we'd have to recycle water. Right now we're only at about 99% for recycling water and we're nowhere close to recycling all of the solid things that people produce. But we would need to recycle all materials effectively. And so learning how to do that would be good. Building a bunch of biospheres here on Earth would be an interesting way to find out about how ecosystems work because we don't know that. Figuring out how to get carbon dioxide out of an atmosphere, that would be useful, right? And you'd want to be doing that on Mars too. So there's some useful things and useful science around sustainability and ecology and climate that could be learned from the idea of trying to do it. But like imagine going to Mars and then needing a medicine. You're going to need a pharmaceutical industry there using inputs which mostly grow on Earth, right? So that's not going to happen. You're going to have your answer is always like, okay, we'll have robots and high-tech equipment to do all of this. Well, if you want to be independent from Earth, you need to be able to make, you know, microchips on Mars, right? And like with a population of 8 billion, we've got 3 companies in the world that can do that, right? Like it takes a mass of people to support those types of industries, right? And so you would need many millions of people to be able to support that. And I don't know what those people are eating, how they're going to live there. If you just look at what it's like to live on a space station or a spaceship, right? Like it's, you lose 1% of your bone mass every month flying along, right? And that's with doing 3 hours of resistance training every day. So, you know, and we're not all a bunch of Chris Hatfields. If you put me on a spaceship to, you know, I also don't think they've really looked at, like, you know, the sort of forcible confinement that you're going to have in this situation, right? Or the sociological things, and also really the people that are planning it aren't planning some democratic, beautiful place for everyone to go and live, right? But it's mostly fiction. It's a con man in the States telling people they're moving to Mars and it'll be better, and it's not going to be. You'd be better off with some meme coin. But I feel like I should say a lot more about it. I'm just so upset about the idea that we would, because one of the justifications is that somehow it's going to rescue our planet, right? Like, we need to have people on another planet so that, like, human society will survive if this planet fails. And I'm like, I can't understand how, like, creating a sustainable society on a dead planet with poison soil and no atmosphere is a likely scenario. Whereas, you know, just trying to, like, you know, manage this one a little better is somehow it gets completely impossible, right? So we should just worry about saving Earth and putting resources into doing that.
And that's an awesome place to end part one. Guess what? This is going to be a two-parter, our very first one. So Rob and John, thank you so much for joining us. And where can listeners find you and maybe even ask more questions?
I have mostly given up on the social internet, so the best place is probably your Discord server.
Amazing. We'll put that in the show notes as well.
Likewise. I think your Discord server is the place to go. Everyone should be joining.
Wizards and Spaceships is a Nightbeats production. It's written and produced by David L. Klink and Rachel A. Rosen. Our theme music is by Rick Innes. You can find more of his music at Anything That Grooves on SoundCloud. Our logo is by Martin Knorr. See more of his work at Flower Prince Draws on Instagram. Our sound bites are from Pixabay. At least half of our dad jokes are by Rohan O'Doyle. You can find show notes, other episodes, and links to our other projects at wizardsandspaceships.ca.